Communicating with the future does not have to be done by psychics or mediums. In fact, Thomas Fry, futurist speaker and author of Communicating with the Future, suggests with a linear, open approach, we can all take a more informed, thus more communicative ride into our futures. Thomas is also director of the Da Vinci Institute in Colorado. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today on Tributaries. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
You are quite a busy fellow. I think your quote, "Until now, ours has been a dance with the ordinary,"
right,
is a great jumping off spot for us. What happened that led you to this statement and your life as a futurist?
Well, I started noticing some of the exponential growth curves that we're facing now, and things are just speeding up on so many different levels. I find it absolutely fascinating that how we're adding intelligence to everything that we're doing. We're parsing innovation into far smaller pieces so more and more people can participate. That means creativity is getting pushed down to the edges. I mean, people can, if they need a prosthetic limb as an example, they can create their own, and they can become very innovative in creating their own prosthetic limb that they get printed out on a 3D printer and things like that.
I don't know if we all knew about that.
yeah, well, not that I'm advocating prosthetic limbs for everybody, but maybe we can actually make exoskeletons that'll make us faster and able to lift far more things. But these are things that we can all start participating in. It's not like these can be left up to the big corporations anymore to essentially design our future. It becomes part of our responsibility now. We all have a role in creating the future, and so we should take that role very seriously.
I heard that as a quote years ago, as don't leave politics to the politicians and music to the professional musicians. And so I like that we're extending this now into just about anything.
Right,
with
right.
our lives here. Let's go to your earlier days, and you were actually an engineer on Star Wars. I just think that must have been fascinating. So to hear a little firsthand snippet of that, I thought would be really interesting.
All right. I was an engineer at IBM, and this is part of Reagan's Star Wars project. So my job was to help design the mobile satellite command and control centers that were on the ground. These were in communications with all of the infrared satellites hovering around the Earth. Now, their role was to detect any missile launches on Earth. Based on the heat plume coming out of the back of the rockets, that created a specific heat signature. And based on that heat signature, anytime a missile is launched anywhere in the world, these satellites would capture that information. And within a few seconds, we would then know what kind of rocket it is, where it's going, how long it's going to take to get there, how much fuel's on board, even probably the serial numbers on the missile itself. So the tons of information coming off of it just based on the heat signature coming out of that rocket.
And so you helped develop picking
yes.
up on that heat signature?
So we were in the process of developing these command centers that were in the back of 18-wheeler trucks that would travel around the United States. And this is old technology by today's standards. It's been shrunk down, and it's, I don't know, maybe in the size of a smartphone today. But I left IBM back in 91, and so that was part of that project.
Your book, Communicating with the Future, talks about re-engineering intentions to alter the master code of our future. What do you mean by the master code, and does it relate to re-engineering a machine, or does that linear path of machinery lead to a dead end as far as what you're considering here?
I spend a lot of time talking about our relationship with the future. Most people don't think about that. Everybody considers that time is pushing us forward. I actually think of it from a little different perspective, that the future is this giant force of nature that's pulling us forward. And so I always talk about, how does the future get created? What role do we have in it? I mean, the person we are at 2 years old, at 4 years old, 10 years old, 20 years old, we look radically different in each of these stages in our life. Our mind is different. Our experiences are different. And so it can be argued that we're not really the same person that we were back then. I mean, we only bear vague similarities to what we were back then. And so this idea of us being the same person, so this, our relationship with the future, and where does the future come from, and how much control do we have over it? And these are all, I think, just fascinating questions. So in this book, I put together this process for us being able to actually project some future vision and then to test it out, and how to get information back from the world around us as to whether or not this was a valid future. And it's kind of an interesting scenario that we can step through. And it all has to do with our relationship with the future. You know, as we go through life, we're constantly betting on our future self. We're investing in education, we're investing in experiences, we're investing in families and relationships. And we're expecting some ROI, some return on that investment. So we invest in these things, and so we want these things to pay off in the future. So somebody going to college, they spending tons of money, they're desperately hoping that they're going to have the income to show to that will help pay it off. That's not necessarily the case, but so anyway, that these are some of the things that we spend a lot of time exploring, and I write about them a lot, and that's kind of my therapy, I guess, trying to explain these things, at least in my head, and other people seem to like what I'm talking about.
Yes. What are some of the markers you would use? You mentioned throwing something out basically about creating for the future, and then you get a feedback.
That's a great question. So if, as an example, I'll use this one example I've used in the past. I wrote a book about flying drones. I wrote a column about it, and there was very few references online to flying drones. And as you expand this vision of flying drones, so you can capture some keyword phrases, whether it's flying drones or something else, but over time, the number of uses of flying drones in the online world has just radically taken off and gone into the stratosphere. And so at a certain point, you get validations through the feedback we're getting in the online world off of keyword phrases. So that's one of the markers that can be used to validate some of our assumptions. So you can create these images of the future. You can put them out there. You can produce them. You can publish them and push them out into the world. And at a certain point, these images then become a self-fulfilling promise, prophecy, if you will, that they've convinced enough people that this is doable and possible that it just becomes kind of common knowledge. And so the future then becomes self-perpetuating based on some of these markers that are put out there.
Do you foresee, for instance, by writing your book, Communicating with the Future, that we all can or should become futurists?
I think it's all in everybody's best interest to know more about the future. See, we're a very backward-looking society, and it's just human nature. We're backward-looking because we've all personally experienced the past. As we look around us, we see evidence of the past all around us. all information that we come into contact with is essentially history. So the past is very knowable, and yet we're going to be spending the rest of our lives in the future. So it's almost as if we're walking backwards into the future. So my job is to help turn people around, to give them some idea of what the future holds. And for a lot of people, thinking about the future is as short-term as what we're going to have for dinner tonight or making my numbers for this quarter, things like that. But having a vision of the future that's 5 years out or 10 years out, it's very important, because this vision that we hold in our head of the future determines our actions today. I use this phrase, the future creates the present. This is just the opposite of what most people think. Most people think what we're doing today is going to somehow create the future. But from a little different perspective, it's these images of the future that we hold in our head determine our actions today. So if we change somebody's vision of the future, we change their decisions today.
Yes, it's very Buddhist in a way. There's something called, I believe, and I'm not a Buddhist, so please, Buddhists who are listening, forgive me. But I had heard that there's something called dependent arising. And it's not about I'm doing this today because of my experience 10 years ago or at birth or whatever. It's because of what needs to happen 6 months or 10 years from now is the reason why I'm doing this, however conscious it is.
Right. Now, when I give talks around the world, I make this promise to my audience. I tell them that I promise that you're going to leave here with a new vision of the future, and as a result, you will be making different decisions from here on out. That's kind of a concrete promise. That's something that's very important. So that kind of validates the purpose of me being there. Corporations can make one slight change in their thinking that could be worth billions of dollars.
And is it formulaic?
Not necessarily.
Is it specific to each instance?
It depends on each situation. I mean, if a company is working on, if they're selling insurance, a couple of my talks over the past year were about the future of risk. And so insurance companies are very interested in how this whole notion of risk is going to change in the future. So as an example, if we have self-driving cars, the risk tends to go down. And at a certain point, I've been estimating sometime between 2030 and 2035, we're going to have roads that become driverless only roads. So you can only get onto these roads if you can switch your car into driverless mode. And once you're able to do that, then the risk of having an accident just plummets. And there's some people that are predicting that within like 20 years, the entire auto insurance industry will be dead, which is, I think, a good thing.
But there are a lot of people who agree with you.
Yeah. We have the potential of eliminating 31,000 deaths a year just in car accidents in the United States alone. That's 2.5 million injuries in cars, 5.5 million car accidents. That can all be eliminated if we have driverless cars, if we automate everything and everything goes according to plan. But there's things that go wrong. So then with an insurance company, then they're wondering, well, where are the new risks? Where and things like having your identity stolen, that's a whole new area. So there's when we solving these problems, it's like this whack-a-mole game where you hit this one thing over the head and something else pops up over here. So
Yes. That's why, you know, the oil industry is like, oh my gosh, we can't have free energy because what would we do? And we would lose all this money and everything. And
But there's new opportunities coming up around the corner all the time.
Yes. And that's the beauty of being a futurist, for sure.
Yeah. So one of the ironic things is, as the price of energy drops, as it gets cheaper and more ubiquitous, it's easier to access. We have energy everywhere, and it starts approaching free. Then we start using a lot more energy. Our need for energy expands exponentially. And what additional capabilities does that give us then? I mean, it raises lots of good questions that we currently don't have good answers for yet.
What do you see the future of the trucking industry, for instance? Do you see robots driving long, overhauling trucks or across the nation?
Great question. Actually, the trucking industry will adopt the driverless technology sooner than the automobile car industry will. I mean, the reason for that is, I mean, they're having a real struggle right now trying to attract enough drivers. So there are experiments going on in Japan, in Finland, and some other countries where they're actually testing out kind of these truck trains, if you will. So they have a driver in the very first truck, and then there's three trucks following behind it, and they all just tag along there. So there's no drivers in the other
like
three.
Magnetics or something?
They have a combination of sensors and signaling that goes on between the vehicles. And so then they can travel in kind of this caravan from one city to the next. And that eliminates 75% of the drivers. So from a cost standpoint, the trucking industry is looking at that and say, we can save a ton of money then transporting stuff across the country. It creates all kinds of other issues in how do you pull off and refuel and things like that. But if you think about the agriculture world has had steering assist in tractors since 2009. So a farmer gets onto a field, they make the first round, and then they just turn it over to the tractor, and it makes back and forth patterns until it paints the rest of the field. And that has been in place since 2009. So having a steering assist technology in the trucking world, and these things will happen kind of in baby steps like this, but a steering assist, if you think about a trucker that gets his rig out onto the interstate, then he puts it in autopilot, and then he turns his chair around and has a little office in the back there, and he can do work on other projects, or he can play video games or watch movies for the next 10 hours as he's traveling to the next city. And then when it gets close by, then he can take over again and steer it through that city. Mm-hmm. That's the one of the near-term baby steps that'll happen.
What does the future, do you think, of information gathering look like? And how much of a shift do you see in actual language happening?
Those are way different areas. So the information gathering, there was a event that happened last year about this time, and it was called the Trillion Sensor Summit. It took place out in San Francisco. And the people that attended that were in charge of creating a roadmap for the future. How long would it take before we reach a trillion sensors in the world? And when I'm talking about sensors, these are basic things like heat sensors and weight sensors and moisture sensors, things like that. And they concluded that we will reach a trillion sensors in the world somewhere around 2024. And then by 2036, we'll reach 100 trillion sensors in the world. So these sensors then become very tiny, very inexpensive, very easy to mass produce, and they're very ubiquitous. They're everywhere. So we start embedding sensors into paints and coatings. We start embedding them into our clothing, the sides of our buildings, the sides of bridges, the sides of our cars.
Why would someone have sensors in their clothing?
We can gather tons of health data off of our bodies just from all of these sensors. There's huge value in, and so we think about everywhere we look, we can get more information off of virtually every surface. There's this phrase called the quantified self, which has to do with all the inputs and outputs of the human body. So we have the ability today to very accurately measure the quality of the air that we're breathing, the quality of water that we're drinking, and at the same time measure the chemical composition of sweat coming out of our arms. Those are things that we can gather tons of information about any problems that we're having and how to optimize the health of our body.
So then here comes all the technology of, my sensor's reading that I have too many chemicals. So then we'll have another little thing that we can perhaps put on our skin or drink or take rebalance.
Yeah, we have the potential to become extremely paranoid about everything. But
I know. I'm sitting here going, let's see. Yeah. I don't know how much longer I have here, but maybe that's okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. Something I wanted to talk to you about was the human there's always an ever-brewing relationship between information and money and power, and humans have constantly gotten bad report cards on what happens to them when they have that power or
right.
all that money. Or, you know, well, I'll just tweak this and I'll make $4 billion more dollars, even though I already have $15 trillion and I don't need any more, but I've got to keep going in this one vein. And coincidentally, or luckily, or happily, there is a big spiritual revolution going on right now as well, which is kind of counterbalancing that other side. And
well, we're very much all flawed individuals. And I wrote a column recently on this that it has to do with our newest unit of measurement called one human intelligent unit. There's a lot of thinking that sometime around 2030 to 2045, machine intelligence will begin to exceed human intelligence. We reach that crossroads. And once we reach that point, then there's all these scary scenarios about what will happen with this artificial intelligence that can take over, that has the ability to rule the world, essentially. And it's and so I go through that whole scenario. It's important, though, that if we're worried about the dangers of artificial intelligence, that we need to be able to measure it. How far along are we? And so if you would think of a scenario of going to buy a new robot for your home 20 years from now, and you had different ratings on it. One was a 2.8 in human intelligence units, and one was 4.6, and one was 24.2, depending on what you're going to use it for. If you wanted to just follow orders, or if you wanted it to be a sparring partner for you to discuss topics of the day on, those are radically different uses. So I thought it would be good to actually start measuring how many human intelligence units are built into this new AIs that are being created. And so as I worked my way through that whole scenario, I came to the conclusion that human intelligence is radically different than artificial intelligence, because we're all flawed humans. And so it'd be very difficult to actually come up with some sort of an assessment, the equivalent of horsepower, if you will, to human intelligence. And so it's opened up this rather kind of radical discussion in the AI world about
what is AI?
Artificial intelligence.
Okay, just wanted everyone to know that. Yeah,
and artificial intelligence is sometimes demonized in the movies. It's becomes the ultimate bad guy, and that threatening to become our arch nemesis in the world. So people are becoming scared of it. But there's a lot of kind of primitive intelligences that we can build into machines, and then if we put them in human hands, they can become very dangerous. And I think that's more of a bigger concern than actually the machines themselves taking over. So
I would contend that a deep dive into the present moment exposes the future and our part in it. Do you ever find yourself slipping into the spiritual? And I bring that up now because of what you're talking about with the artificial intelligence. And I was just speaking to someone about deadly medicines and their combinations, and how, well, they have all the trial tests, and yes, we all know we can't necessarily trust what they publish, but there's something different that goes on with the human. I mean, there has to be that spiritual peace or that connection to creation, and I don't, you know, want to get into any particular religion or anything here, but that can't be, I can't deny that. You know, and so, you know, they can talk about trials their whole lives, but each individual is going to react or have a different reaction to a certain medicine or something like that. So there is no cut and dry, this does this.
So I try to remain above that, the fray, if you will, because there's lots of debates going over about science and religion. But I did write a couple columns that opened kind of a can of worms. One of them was titled 10 Questions That Neither Science Nor Religion Can Answer. And I was totally amazed at all the people that came in there and tried to answer all of them. And the first question is why is there an exception to every rule? Which is really kind of a fascinating question as you dive into that. But then I wrote another column on which requires more faith, science or religion. And that again opened up a whole can of worms that got lots of debate. A lot of the writing I do is a type of therapy as I'm kind of working through these issues in my own mind. And I certainly don't claim to have all the answers, but as you kind of work through the thinking, the thought patterns and all of this, and I think that's helpful for other people as well.
Yes. Well, Thomas, we're winding down time-wise, but a couple things I just want to, and maybe you can respond in a sentence or so. You have two important, the Da Vinci Institute.
Right.
Is something you've created, and that's wonderful. And I just wanted to put it out there so people can hear basically what that is, and we'll give them a way to connect with you, of course.
Yeah, the Da Vinci Institute is a futurist think tank. We're based in Louisville, Colorado, right next to Boulder. We offer a number of workshops and innovative programs. We've found that one of our big projects right now is working on this area of microcolleges.
Which brings up the coding school, which is brilliant. And
right.
I appreciate it. It's not... I don't foresee myself going there, but I just love that you have that as an offering. It's wonderful.
Yeah, there's this whole issue of technological unemployment about people losing their jobs because they're automated out of existence is going to be a huge problem in the future. And we've projected out that by 2030, the average person will have to reboot their career 6 times. And so somebody who reboots their career wants to do it in the least amount of time possible, which makes traditional colleges a very poor fit. So we've put together this program. It's a 13-week program for training people in computer programming languages, and then we can help them get a job in a short period of time, not a long period.
Yeah. What's the job for the person in 30 years or in 20 years?
It's going to be a moving target. The driver jobs are probably going to go out of existence. There's janitorial cleaning jobs will probably go out of existence. There's kind of the repetitious, the mundane, the simple jobs, but even some of the more complicated ones. I mean, we may have far fewer real estate agents, as an example, or far fewer attorneys because we can automate a lot of the processes they used in the past. So I wrote a recent column on 101 endangered jobs in the world today.
Right. So how are the economies going to handle that?
We have to constantly be readapting people. I mean, on one hand, we're losing jobs. On the other hand, we're freeing up human capital. So what should we be pushing that human capital to do?
So will be an economy and people will get paid for things and...
Yeah, I mean, if you ask this fundamental question of, are we going to run out of work in the world? That's kind of preposterous. No, we're never going to run out of work in the world, but are there jobs aligned with all the work that needs to be done? That's a whole other question. So we need to actually create systems for creating new jobs, and the new jobs will happen as a result of new industries. This is what I call catalytic innovation, and so I think we need to do more catalytic innovation.
Thomas Fry, author of Communicating with the Future and director of the DaVinciInstitute.com, will be with us next week with more about this fantastic world we live in. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.